Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. We kicked off this Thursday night with Ultravox and Sleepwalk. I'm putting that one out to the to all the citizenry everywhere, really. I guess Sleepwalk seems fairly appropriate. That was followed by Eat Static's Crash and Burn. I'm sure at the moment, Crash and Burn is certainly what it looks like. But, of course, if we look a little bit more closely, I suspect precedent suggests that we'd find that it's actually an elegant mixture of covert demolition and arson. And finished with Emerald from Thin Lizzy. To the towns they bought plunder, swords and flame. When they left, the towns were empty and the children would never play again. For sure, the methods may be changing, but it seems to me that the agenda remains unchanged. Big thanks, of course, to Mike Sinclair and Jason and Andy for the show before, which I think was really fascinating. What a lot of ground was covered there. And hopefully similar things are going to happen on this show, because I'm really pleased to say that I've got a lot of hiss on this line. Let me just try and, there we go, that's probably going to make it better for me. Hopefully you can all hear me out there, that's looking a lot better. I'm very pleased to say that I'm joined this evening by Stella Berg to talk about homeopathy and complementary therapy, and there's every chance we'll stray into a few other topics on the way through, I suspect. So thanks very much for joining us, Stella, and we really appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for inviting me on.
That's okay, I'll see you're not coming through my headphones at all. I'll just try and adjust your volume a little bit. That's great. Yes, so we already had a pretty fascinating chat. Just wondering why I'm getting a lot of background noise. Hopefully somebody on the chat box will let me know what it sounds out there. As people know, we like to concentrate on communication and community and consciousness as kind of key areas. For us to kind of seek solutions to our current challenges, and I reckon we're probably going to touch on a lot of that sort of thing tonight. But I know you wanted to make clear that it's your hope that we're going to actually enable listeners during this conversation to catch up on a few practical details that can support their health and development, don't you?
I think people need to start taking charge of their health again. Basically, once you've farmed it out to professionals, you lose control and understanding of your own body and your own health. And it's not wise to put it in the hands of somebody you don't know and possibly have reason to not trust.
Yes, yeah, quite so. And as you say, kind of homeopathy is essentially non-toxic, isn't it? There's no real difference in essentially between lay people and potential practitioners.
Well, there's the knowledge difference, but the thing is that if you want to start using homeopathy, you have to be both persistent and stupid to hurt yourself, except in a few rare occasions. But basically, it's very safe to experiment with, it's very safe to learn on, and the spectrum between doing it yourself at home all the way up to being a very experienced professional is one that anybody can embark on. And if you go back a few hundred years, you know, every householder had a still room who had the room for it and knew a great deal about helping themselves. And although homeopathy is a slightly different method, the basics haven't changed. It's about taking responsibility for your health. And I've always advocated that, and I teach a lot of people how to do it for themselves.
Because one of the basically important things is, surely, that we do start taking responsibility, and the best place to begin is with our own stuff, isn't it, really?
Well, we have this curious system in this country whereby doctors are paid by one person to help another. And if you think about it, it splits your loyalties. So to take a really very common situation, if a married woman goes to a doctor and says, I'm depressed, the doctor's job, basically, is to send her back home to get back to work. But if she has a relationship with somebody like me, my entire responsibility and my contract is directly to her. So that my responsibility is to get her better. And if that involves her leaving her husband, that's what I will try and get her to look at.
And of course, there might be things in between that, mightn't there? It might be that she simply needs to take a break, or that she needs to find new ways of expressing herself.
Oh, hopefully, yes, of course. I don't specialise in getting people to leave their partners.
I don't think they seem to need any help, do they, really?
No. But what I'm trying to get at is that a doctor's job actually is working for the government. And if you don't realise that when you go and see one, you may not understand that sometimes their job is to make you shut up and go away and pipe down, when what you need is to get up and jump about shouting. And that's why an awful lot of people who are on antidepressants ought actually be in rebellion against their lives. So they go and see a doctor. Doctor works for the government. Doctor's job is to shut them down. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, and to sell pharmaceuticals.
And to sell pharmaceuticals. But when you are looking to treat yourself, you have to look at yourself in a slightly different way and include in your basic analysis of I've got a terrible cold and my nose is dripping and my eyes are running, the question why. So, for example, it's not at all uncommon when people get colds that they're crying. And if you've been brought up to not feel that it's okay to cry, then your body will cry for you.
Right.
A cold is a form of crying. Not always, of course. But in some cases, cystitis is a very common form of crying. And if you want to start treating yourself, you need to look at yourself with a certain detachment and think about the body as an intelligent organism, and it's got a reason for doing what it's doing. So, yeah. For example, Louise Hay wrote a book about this many years ago, which is fascinating. It's about the correlations of different parts of the body with emotions.
That's a fabulous book. I can't remember what it's called. I read it a while back.
Heal Your Life, I think.
That's the one, yeah.
But there are correlations. And, you know, language, magic spelling and language, marvellous stuff. We actually say these things. When people get holes in their teeth, it's almost always because they're bullied. And you think about the expressions that we use for teeth. You know, clenching our teeth, biting the bullet, gritting our teeth. They're all about rage.
Right.
Funny that.
That's very interesting, says the man with only three teeth left.
What made you angry then, Ben?
I suspect it was probably essentially to do with early domestic life. Let's just put it that way, shall we?
Right. Well, that is a very common pattern. And I think the best part of any sort of healing is, rather than rushing to find something to take the pain away, is to look at why you've got it. And once you start on that route, then you grow as well.
Well, that is fundamentally, I think, the distinction between your medical doctor and your homeopath, isn't it? Is that one of them tends to kind of cover up the symptoms, and the other one endeavours to reach the cause of the symptoms and deal with that, and hence the symptoms.
Interestingly enough, I was reading a brief article in the Canary this morning about how there'd been a pilot experiment with doctors where they got 30 minutes with their patients, and, you know, their outcomes were so much better without changing anything else.
Yes, I think that sometimes it is a matter of just time. 10 minutes is clearly not enough, but at the same time, by way of contrast, I was really impressed, as we'll hear later, with your questioning routine, which led to some very interesting conclusions about my type in less than 10 questions, I reckon. And I get similar results when I deal with kinesiologists. They can sort out what's wrong really quickly. They could make better use of the 10 minutes, is what I'm saying, but half an hour is much better than 10. I guess that's my point.
Well, also, you have to have the background. You know, homeopathy will never be successful with doctors because it requires personal attention. And if you want to do people basically as a job lot, you know, you all have headaches, you all have headache painkillers. It doesn't work very well on individuals.
No.
You, We're not identical. One of the things I do with my students right at the beginning of a course, because I train homeopaths, is I go around the room and I ask people to describe their colds. And we get at least 12 different kinds of colds. You know, whether they go to the chest or the throat or the ears or the headaches or, you know, whether they make your nose sore or whether you lose your voice.
Does that tend to be a lifelong pattern? Do your colds always tend to go to the same place, or do individuals get different ones as time goes by?
Now that is a very good question. Things change gradually. Do you remember the old-fashioned image of an atom with a nucleus and the electrons running around it?
I do.
Well, constitutions are like the nucleus, and the acute remedies, that is for colds and flus and headaches and tummy upsets and stuff, tend to be the same electrons going round and round, the same constitution. But over the course of 15 or 20 years, yes, people hopefully grow and develop, and they will change.
Right. So that's basically your, if you're talking about electrons and stuff, you're talking about charge. So is there a connection here between the homeopathic remedies and charge?
Well, there is, because the reason that homeopathic remedies work is actually very simple, and there for anybody who wants to research it is remedies have a small electrical field. Many years ago, I was fortunate enough to set up a pharmacy, homeopathic pharmacy, with a friend. So I made a lot of remedies. And we endeavoured to do what is known as Curlian photography on the remedies, and they each have a small electrical field. And if you touch the remedy with your hand, you've taken it.
That's why I was always told to tip the remedy into the lid of the bottle and then tip it into my mouth.
That's the one.
Right, okay. Never understood why that was the case, just trusted it.
Well, it certainly seems to work that way. don't know why homeopathy works is nobody's putting any money into finding out.
No, well, we'll get on to the proving shortly, because that is, again, when I was talking to you, it was the first time I'd really understood that. I just want to dig in a little bit more to the nature of what it is we're talking about, because not everybody's experienced homeopathy. I've got years of experience with it, and I'm dead impressed by it, I must admit. But can we just go back to the question of depression, because I'm quite interested in that specifically, for a couple of reasons. Partly because I know a lot of people are using what used to be known as Prozac, and partly because Prozac's copyright or whatever is has now run out, which means it will no longer be turning up as Prozac. It will be turning up as a thousand different things. And I've had a suspicion that people have got good reason to be depressed because of the suppressed realizations of what's going on around them. But how would a homeopath approach somebody who comes with the symptoms of depression? What would you be doing with them?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I speak not just as a homeopath, but as myself, because we're all very individual in the way we work.
I've noticed that.
Well, if someone comes to me and says they are depressed, the first thing is I question whether the label is of any use. Because quite often, if you imagine somebody's energy, right, if you are busy, if you need to go down to your core or your base and do some exploring and some sorting out and some mending, you have descended down and your energy is down there. It's not available to you in everyday life. And people often feel they're depressed when they've got that. May not be depression at all. They may be busy.
Indeed. So it might be called inner work rather than lower work.
Yes. And because we are discouraged from looking inward from an early age in our culture, very often they don't recognise that that's what's going on. So that is a very common cause of people feeling low and lack of energy. So that's one. Another one is covered up anger, of course. If you suppress anger, or if you suppress any strong feeling, sexuality, for example, then you can end up feeling very fatigued and very low.
And that's an interesting challenge in itself, isn't it? Because if you suppress it, you make yourself sick. If you express it, you get yourself into trouble.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, it's socially unacceptable to have loud feelings and strong feelings in our culture. So those are two of several different reasons why somebody might come along saying they're depressed. And I think the other thing is we are very averse to discomfort and pain in our culture. We're taught to be. If you're hurting at all, numb it. Without realising, that doesn't make it go away. It just makes you stop feeling it. And so, for example, you know, if your father has just died, you're unhappy. You're grieving. And the best way through it is to go through it rather than to try and just disappear it.
Right. So, yeah, I was just going to ask that because I tend not to take painkillers and to actually just lie down and get into the pain until it, and then it goes away, generally.
Yes. I mean, I think there is a cultural mindset that feels we have a right to be happy all the time. Mm. And if you want to grow, you know, Blake said, sorrows impregnate and joys bring forth. And I go with that. You need sorrows. All people who grow up carry scars, you know, psychological scars, and it's part of what makes you grow, and it's very valuable. What it is people who are unhappy need to be supported through that and loved through that, but not necessarily have the pain taken away from them.
And that's probably where old communities would work a lot better than current ones, where almost everything that requires a little bit of support nowadays needs commercial interaction of some sort with people who couldn't give a toss.
Yes.
Mm.
So having said all that, if somebody does have depression, I have remedies for that. But we always look and integrate what is going on with that person first, because it isn't just about disappearing the pain. Healing is about making whole, isn't it?
It is.
Therefore, to cut the pain out of somebody's life is not going to make them whole. It's just going to leave them with a hole.
Mm. And no resolution.
And no resolution, exactly. And no insight into what the process was.
Mm.
So, you know, it's very much more subtle, I think, than just giving people tablets.
Yes, because, I mean, basically you seek information by careful questioning to kind of to physical and spiritual well-being. And I noticed you separated in a list you gave me the emotions from spirit. So are we talking about hormones and the endocrine system, our actual kind of chemical body there?
That's part of it, yes, very much so. my goodness, where do I start with all that? Emotions are, I suppose, one way I would see it, is they're a bit like the tide washing up and down on the shore. And one of the things a healer can do, which is of lasting help, is support the shore underneath so it doesn't become a quicksand. Mm. I quite like that as an extended metaphor.
You've got some very subtle and beautiful metaphors, and that's another goodie, I think.
Well, trying to develop a sort of tranquility that underlies your emotional tossing and turning is again, it's a very important part of healing. If you can sit with hurt or grief or emotional turmoil and be patient with yourself, then you can walk with it, knowing it won't always be there.
And if you can walk with it, then there's quite often something to be learned from it, isn't there?
Invariably, I would say.
Mm. So we're talking about, a therapy that, you know, can help everybody, young parents, developing souls, young people and old people, everybody can effectively learn simple, safe, relevant and important skills and identify resources that they regularly need. I know when I first got interested in homeopathy, it was through first aid. I started looking for the homeopathic solutions with the support, obviously, of the lady I was working with, for things like shock and bruising and bleeding, and made myself familiar with those. Would you think that's a good way to start?
It's an excellent way to start. The reason being that, by and large, remedies are tailor-made for individuals. As I said, you know, if you have 10 different kinds of colds, then there is not specifically a remedy for a cold. But for trauma, there are remedies which are so common that people can learn them very readily. So, for example, the one that nearly everybody starts with is Arnica.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful, it's lovely, beautiful, wonderful remedy. The Germans call it Fallkraut, for falling down mountains. And, you know, whenever anybody's injured, arnica, it's got some lovely qualities. It stops blood being in the wrong place. So if you've got if you're bleeding heavily, if you've bruised yourself a lot, all the way up to heart attacks and strokes, arnica will reduce the bleeding and the bruising, and it will even reduce the shock somewhat.
Yeah, I found that it also helped with things like exam stress and before visits to the dentist and things like that. You don't have to take it after the event, really.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, I think also people's faith in it gets to be so great that, you know, they know it's going to work. And so you have the wonderful placebo effect coming in to help.
That's absolutely half the battle, isn't it?
It is, yes. You know, I know plenty of people who carry arnica about with them. And indeed, when my son was small, he had some under his bike saddle and some under his skateboard.
Yeah, and under the skateboard. Bloody great idea.
Absolutely. Well, it was very useful one day because he did come crashing down and crack his skull. And his friends gave him arnica and then phoned me up because they were all told about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, actually, there's not a lot a hospital can do for a cracked skull.
No.
Arnica, making sure there isn't a hemorrhage in the membranes in the brain, and then going to see an osteopath the next day was all he needed.
Tell me, because I was carrying two sorts of arnica. I was carrying one called arnica 30 for average use, and one called arnica 200 for when I hit myself with lump hammers and stuff. If they're potentized, what's the difference between a 30 and a 200?
I have to give you the short answer there.
Yes, please.
Generally speaking, in first aid only, 200 is for greater intensity.
Yeah, okay.
That's probably the simple way to put it.
Right.
So, for example, there's a lovely remedy, belladonna, which is good for fevers in children, amongst other things, including meningitis. And it is the most fearsome fever that children get, where their temperature goes very, very high. So we tend to use belladonna in 200.
Right, okay.
Whereas for a snuffly cold, we'd be more likely to use a 30.
So it's for kind of speed and density of onset?
Yes, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So, for example, in any first aid kit, we usually have a set of 30th potency because they're the most useful general potency.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know a little bit more, then you would have a higher potency of the remedy Hypericum, which is St. John's wort, which is fantastic for shutting fingers in car doors and other sort of oof kind of hurts. And we'd use that in a 200 because hurty hurts are very nasty.
Yeah, I love Hypericum because I was I had a small bout of being bitten by mosquitoes when I was living in Oxfordshire. And they had a tendency to actually bite the veins on my hands, and then my hand would swell up like a rubber glove. And I ended up, I think a GP offered me antihistamines, but I went to the homeopath and she gave me Hypericum 30 tablets and Hypericum tincture and said, because you know you feel instantly you get bitten by a horsefly or a mosquito, you know it's happened. She said, instead of rushing around, go and sit in the shade, put a drop of the Hypericum tincture on the bite, take a Hypericum little Hypericum bomb and just sit for 15 minutes. And I swear you could feel it all just going away. I carry them around with me everywhere I go now as well. Although now that they know I've got a solution, the mosquitoes don't bite me no more.
Yes, that also is quite familiar. Yeah. Well, it's to me, even after I've been working on homeopathy for 36 years and it is still a daily miracle.
Mm.
You know, I'm so grateful to know about it because I've never seen anything that works like that. If I did, I'd abandon homeopathy without a backward glance.
Mm. Yes.
But magic.
I tend to admit that in the correct hands, it seems to be little short of miraculous. And yes, folks, you can try this at home. It's safe, sensible and responsible, Stella said to me the other day. And I like sensible there because it means available to the sense, because it really is. You can see it and feel it making a difference. I mean, have you ever tried homeopathying somebody and finding that they just don't respond?
Yes. Yes, there are a very few people who won't respond. And generally speaking, they don't respond to acupuncture or chiropractic or osteopathy either.
Mm.
That's interesting. And a few people refuse to respond, and that's also very interesting. Often it's children who are in conflict with their parents who've dragged them along for behavioural control.
Right.
We don't do. Or occasionally it's stressed husbands.
Right.
You can refuse to let it in.
It's important that you make some sort of invitation on your behalf, isn't it? Which is why I can imagine being dragged there by your parents might cause a few problems.
Generally speaking, if someone is of an age to be asked, I'll ask them if they're willing.
Yeah.
And if they're, then we have a discussion about it, because everybody of any age has a right to choose. With the single exception, I think, of an abusive person who's hurting someone else.
Right, yeah. And could you, under those circumstances, intervene?
No comment.
Okay, cool. Okay. So another thing you emphasised, which I think is really important when we were chatting before, was the importance of learning through doing and through conversation with others. I think that's a really good point because, again, we have a tendency to leave all manner of things to others that we could actually do ourselves.
One of the things I've been doing in the last few months is I'm privileged to go to a mums and babies group with my grandson. And all the group have shown interest in homeopathy, and I'm trying to organise them into a self-help group. And I'll start them off with basics, like, you know, this is where your liver is and your kidney, and these are the commonest ailments of children. These are the dangerous ailments of children. And this is how first aid kit works. And as they learn, they will talk to each other and tell each other the stories of what happened to them. And they will learn much faster as a cohesive group.
Another of the beauties of community.
Absolutely it is.
Information spreads so much more quickly amongst willing participants. It's, I think, one of the most important reasons for why the World Management Team tries so hard to keep us apart. That's how they can rule us, if we don't work together.
Yes, it's true. It's very true. And I think that's one of the things that is happening, is that people are beginning to come together again, because, frankly, I think the great problem, particularly of this country, is loneliness.
Mm. Yeah, loneliness and nature deficit disorder.
You know, I had a thought a couple of weeks ago. You know this image of the English with stiff upper lip being unfriendly and cold and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm in my 60s, and I don't remember that being a current expression as a child. I think it's a meme that's been thrust upon us.
That would be interesting. I suspect we could probably find that out with a quick look in the search engine. If anybody in the chat box wants to look up that particular phrase, stiff upper lip, see when it was first used, that would be quite an interesting bit of input.
Just, but post-war, people were very community-minded.
Yes, yeah, and I, you know, talking to some of the oldsters who survived the Second World War, when you look in their eyes, you can see a kind of sparkle when they talk about those times. So, yeah, it was risky, and, yeah, you came out of the air raid shelters and found people's arms hanging from the trees and stuff. But by and large, I always feel there's a kind of undercurrent that in those days there was a kind of freedom, partly because you didn't know what was going to happen next. But I just get, do you ever get that from them?
Yes, very much so.
Mm.
And also, I mean, our communities have been deliberately broken up. I mean, people have known for decades how to build village greens and houses with doors looking at each other to build community, and they don't build them.
No, they don't. In fact, they're busily trying to develop village greens and take them off people at the moment, which I think, you know, part of the last land grab, as it were.
Yes, and to keep people separated and gated and all apart from one another.
Yeah.
Because certainly therein lies our strength. And, you know, the miners were a splendid example of that. And, of course, they had to be trashed.
Well, as you know, I'm hoping to have another discussion with you at some point about land rights and rebellion and all the rest of it, because I think we've got plenty to explore there. But before we have a quick look at the history of homeopathy, which itself is pretty interesting, how did you find your way to it, or have you been a witch from birth?
Well, my great-grandmother was a healer, apparently. I was thinking about answering this question because I knew you'd ask me. When I was 18 and living in my first flat in London, shared flat, we were sitting round the fire talking about what we wanted to do with our lives, and out popped the oddest expression, I want to be wise and I want a chance to be happy. I've never had any reason to change it, but I had to wait 12 years before I could study homeopathy because, interestingly, somewhere in the 60s, all the homeopaths, all the prominent homeopaths in England, got into an aeroplane to go to a conference in Switzerland and the plane crashed and they all died. Funny that. So there wasn't any training in this country at all. And when I met somebody who was going to the first college's first year and talked to me about it, it was an absolute revelation. And I got on my bike and I cycled right across London, which I've never done before or since, and arrived at their door, clutching fistfuls of money, saying, you've got to teach me.
Suddenly the mission became clear.
I'd been looking for it. I did loads of jobs, from being a clown, which was good fun, to social work, to teacher, to all sorts of many different things, all useful. But it wasn't until I found out about homeopathy that I decided that's what I was here for. I've never had any reason to change that.
I would guess from that moment forward, it was a kind of real voyage of joyful discovery, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed it was. It fits me like a glove, and I'm quite clear that's what I'm here for.
Here's one from Rob Freeman from the chat box. It says, stiff upper lip. The phrase is similar to bite the bullet, keep your chin up, and, to the amusement of many Americans, keep your pecker up. It has become symbolic of the British and particularly of the products of the English public school system during the age of the British Empire. In those schools, the play up and play the game ethos was inculcated into the boys who went on to rule the empire. That do your duty and show no emotion attitude was expressed in Alfred Lord Tennyson's The Charge of the Light Brigade. Thank you very much for that, Rob.
Brilliant.
Yep. So. Just about says what we needed to know, doesn't it?
Yes.
So for a while, because of a plane crash, there was no homeopathic training, and you got in there at the beginning. Sort of roughly when was that?
The first college started in 1979.
That's strange, isn't it? Because we must have had the five first hospitals, I'm told, were homeopathic hospitals, so they must still have been there. How were they?
The peak of homeopathy was somewhere in the 1870s, 1880s. All the homeopathic hospitals were started by public subscription, which I believe, although I'm not sure, is why the NHS can't close them.
Do you know which ones they are? Just as a matter of interest, I've never looked.
East Grinstead, Tunbridge Wells is closed. Mm-hmm. Liverpool, I think, is closed. Bristol is still going. London is still going. Glasgow, bless it, keep its teeth firmly fixed in being alive.
Oh, I love the Glaswegians.
Absolutely. And Taylor Riley, who runs it, is real. He's a really great homeopath, and he's pig-headed as anything. He's going to keep it open.
Brilliant. So they managed to close some of them, even though open by public subscription, that is unlawful.
Yes, I believe so, because the strategy with London is to refuse to allow all the doctors in the neighbouring boroughs to send any patients there, and then they can close it because there's no need for it, and it becomes the old London Homeopathic Hospital.
Another favourite world management team gameplay there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, directing people to other places, changing the boundaries, changing the rules a little bit. So, kind of end of the 19th, early of the 20th century, lots of doctors were homeopaths, especially those in the countryside.
Somewhere between a fifth and a quarter, so that the image we have of your family doctor, who is warm, friendly, knows your constitution, now there's a homeopathic word, and always takes the time to be genial and ask you a lot of questions, that's never been a picture of an ordinary doctor, that's always been a picture of a homeopath.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I certainly don't remember any of my doctors being like that, and I was subjected to doctors from a very early age for one reason or another. Up until recent times, I was interested by this particular list as well. You reckon we had medical doctors, who were the people we now know as GPs, apothecaries, who are presumably pharmacists of some sort.
That's right. That's
midwives, Barber surgeons, I've always been interested by that phrase. What is the connection between a barber and a surgeon?
Are they often doubled as butchers? Does that answer the question?
Great, let's move on, shall we? And, probably still, I mean, you know, times change, eh? Ha ha, thankfully. And which women?
Which women?
Yeah.
Well, herbalists and midwives, mostly.
Yep, yep. Cunning folk, women with wisdom.
Yes, but there have always been wise people, the majority of whom were women, I think probably because they had the time, because when they were bringing up the children, they were at home and walking around the local area and gathering food anyway.
And also because they probably had time to be familiar with their landscape and what was available in it.
Yes. I had an interesting experience this year. There is a wonderful group called the Radical Herbalists who meet various places in England. And I go to their group. And I'd just been watching an ancient film on television. And there was a little very short clip about using an alembic, which is a medieval still. You've heard of still rooms, which is where you do your medicines.
Yeah.
Well, an alembic is the domestic still with which you can make flower essences and herbal essences. So I found a local potter, and he made me 14 alembics, and I took them up to the Radical Herbalists, who just gobbled them up instantly. And we've introduced something that hasn't been seen in England for 300 years, and it's been very exciting.
And we know that reintroducing something or doing something like that makes it easier for more people and more likely that other people will reintroduce it elsewhere.
Absolutely. Mm. I should emphasise for the alcoholics amongst your listeners that you can't make alcohol with these. You can only use a little tiny bit of alcohol to make herbal tinctures.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about vast quantities here.
Mm. Great to be able to make your own tinctures, though. Some folk will remember a show we did with Fred Gillam about the magic of mushrooms and some of the mushroom tinctures you can get, which are really huge spectrum effective.
Oh, yes. Mushrooms are amazing, really.
Yeah, it's still one of the best shows. More people downloading that than any of the others over the last 5 years, interestingly. I think a lot of the solution is in the mushrooms, but at the time we're talking about, they probably hadn't recognised mushrooms as relevant at all because they were still believing in balancing the four humours, weren't they? And I've been racking my name for the fourth one. I've got sanguine, melancholic, phlegmatic, and I couldn't remember the other one.
Rubric, sanguinarius, sanguinous.
Yeah, I think I've got that one. Never mind, it will come to me eventually, or they can go looking for that as well and put it in the chat box, it's fine. But they basically balanced these imaginary humours by using purging and bleeding, didn't they? And that was mainly what they were doing, apparently?
They used those, and they used what were known as heroic doses. So, for example, there were three remedies which were greatly admired because they were actually effective, which just says a great deal for the others. And they were sulfur, mercury, and quinine. Sulfur was known as a specific, that is, almost universal cure for skins, mercury for syphilis, and quinine for malaria. And interestingly, our beloved founder, Samuel Hahnemann, when he was looking for a therapeutic tool that was better than what the doctors were using in his time, he accidentally took a dose of quinine and was fascinated to find that he developed the symptoms of malaria. Because he knew it cured malaria, of course, but he'd never tried taking it when nobody needed it. And so he took some more and he developed malaria again, and then it went away. And then he tried it on his long-suffering friends and family, and they all developed symptoms of malaria. And so he discovered the principle of what something can cure, it can cause.
So he was getting only the symptoms, effectively, because they went away again. He wasn't actually getting the malaria.
That's right.
Wow. That's, I mean, you know, one assumes that doing that to your wife and friends would not go down well with the tabloids today. Was there any comment made about his experiments?
I'm afraid I'm using that as poetic license, Ben. The part of the tale I tell, I have no real idea if he did that. But he did get a whole load of followers, and he started trying out different mild poisons on them to see what symptoms they developed. And then he started trying to use it on people who had those illnesses with the same symptoms. And he decided he'd stumbled on this principle, which is the homeopathic principle, or cure by similars. There was one big problem, and that was that some of the things he was using were toxic. So he started diluting his medicines. And he diluted and he shook them, which seems an odd thing to do, but it seems to transfer an electrical pattern to the substance that you are diluting, so that the more diluted it becomes, the stronger the energy in it becomes.
It's known that moving water energizes it, isn't it? Doesn't it? Especially moving it in a spiral.
A vortex, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So, hence, if you dilute arsenic, which is not a very poisonous poison, actually, if you dilute it several million times and you give it to people persistently, it's very interesting because most of them will produce diarrhea and vomiting, burning in the stomach, feeling of great weakness, fear of death, very, very chilly. And those are the commonest symptoms of severe food poisoning.
Brilliant.
Hence, we try out all our remedies, since now we've diluted them to the point of not being toxic. We test them out on well volunteers in fairly large numbers, and we collate the symptoms as they develop them, so that we have a very precise knowledge of what our remedies can do. And this system, which we call proving, is actually what something we invented, and the doctors call it placebo-controlled double-blind testing. Mm-hmm. We invented it.
I never knew that that's where it came from, because it's interesting, isn't it, that I would imagine that subsequent to homeopaths coming up with the double-blind placebo-controlled trial, subsequent to that, the physicists noticed that certain minds can seriously upset experiments. And it upset experimental gear. Now, obviously, they don't take any account of that in most of their experiments, even though they found out that that happens even in really physical experiments, like dropping an iron bar from the top of a building. They don't take it into account. But in theory, it's used for all drug testing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But the interesting thing is the placebo results themselves change as well. You know, there's this wonderful TEDx lecture. Do you know about TEDx?
I like the TEDx lectures. Which one have you got for us?
Rupert Sheldrake's.
Yeah, I love Rupert Sheldrake.
Yeah, and basically, if I understand him correctly, the message is, well, you know, like carbon atoms have four electrons on the whole, but sometimes they have three or five, and occasionally they have 17. It's all much more bendy than doctors and scientists like to believe.
Yeah, Rupert pointed out that actually there's a new book of universal constants published on a fairly regular basis. He went to see a guy who came in with a whole trolley full of them. So the speed of light, for example, is not a constant, and it would appear, at least according to Rupert, none of the others are as well. That book, if nobody's read it, The Science Delusion, is absolutely brilliant. Well worth getting a look at. So let's just whip through another couple of bits of this history, because it gets a bit hot now with the creation of the BMA and stuff, and then we'll have a bit of a music break, shall we?
Mm.
So there was a cholera outbreak in London. Can you tell that how that led to the undoing of the homeopaths?
Well, there had always been a lot of competition between them, but I think it was 1894, but don't quote me on that. There was a really very severe cholera outbreak. And across London, the death rate was about 47% as a statistic given by the hospitals. So inmates of hospitals, 47% of those coming in with cholera died, except in the homeopathic hospital where the death rate was 4%.
That's lucky, eh?
So, yeah. So a bunch of doctors got together and invented the British Medical Association. And in its very early meetings, it is on record as saying, we recognise this statistic, but we're not going to publish it lest people should be misled. And from that point, they started giving credence to doctors who had had the standard, so-called allopathic medical training, and they started excluding the homeopaths and regarding them as unqualified. And so they were pushed out and out and out and out. They weren't included in the general current of doctors, and by the time they got to the post-war construction of the NHS, they weren't permitted to be in there unless they also had a standard medical qualification.
And there's a couple of other examples of standard world management techniques, which is massaging the figures you do publish, not publishing the ones you don't want people to see.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the another standard gameplay of, again, changing the rules, redefine. I like redefine and redeem, deeming people to be something different from what they were yesterday.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's how polio was eradicated, you know. It was eradicated by definition and replaced by flaccid paralysis.
Yes, gave it a different name, and this is what we mean, isn't it, when we talk about the power of words as spells. Everybody knows about polio, you change its name, looks like it's disappeared.
Yes. Well, I've treated polio twice in this country and twice in India, and it is as easy to treat as any other ailment, and responds beautifully to homeopathy, which kind of begs the question of why are you going to have vaccines if you've got a much better solution to it?
Yes, well, I was going to suggest that we give vaccines a bit of a kicking on the way by, because it's kind of traditional, because as well as changing the name of polio, if you do actually go looking for vaccination programs and then for subsequent patterns of disease outbreak, you find that there's a pretty close correlation between the two, don't you?
Yes. Yes, and also that most vaccines were introduced after the relevant disease was already in decline. So, for example, measles was the second greatest killer of children before 1900. But by 1950, when it was introduced, it was already down to about, 1 or 2% of what it had been before. So the vaccine had absolutely no impact on the incidence of very severe measles.
See, there was a lot of measles and chicken pox and stuff around when I was a kid, lots of it, and they used to have chicken pox and measles parties. We all used to go around to catch it.
Well, they all go through waves of intensity and mildness. And because we had, up until recently, a well-fed, well-sanitized population, children should get those diseases, but they didn't get them severely because they were strong. Where these diseases are killers are in a starved, half-starved and poor population without access to clean water.
Yes. Yeah. What do you think of the argument, just as a last question? I've always been puzzled by this idea that if you don't have your offspring vaccinated, you are in some sense endangering the vaccinated herd. I'm not quite sure of the logic of that. Can you explain it to me, perhaps?
There is no logic. If it is protective of people, they don't need to be afraid of people who are not vaccinated, do they?
Well, that's what I would have thought. It seems to me that they're actually revealing the true nature of the vaccines by making that argument. And as was, of course, Mr. Microshaft when he was heard grouping vaccinations with birth control in another TED talk, I believe. Got a laugh, haven't you? Well,
when I lived in London, I treated the families of, I think it was 16 GPs from other areas, everyone, who brought their children to me because they didn't vaccinate.
Well, you see, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? It does seem to me that the people I know, who are many who work for the NHS and don't seem to be willing to take on board, say, things like especially the flu vaccine. I'm not sure you find professionals accepting them often, do you?
Quite a lot of people are brain dead in that respect. They don't get told. But from my point of view, if I look at Big Pharma, it is medicine is a mature market. Everybody already has all the medicines they want. And for a large company to make enough profit for its shareholders to stop the CEO being sacked in favor of somebody who will make more profit, they have to find sources of profit every year. And it's getting harder and harder because since everyone's got all the drugs they want, you can't really grow the market any further. There's only two current areas of expansion. One is taking alternatives away from people so they have to use drugs. And the other one is forcing vaccines on people.
And inventing new diseases.
and inventing new diseases. Mm. That's three then.
Yeah.
But we have reached a plateau point, and Big Pharma will fall apart of its own accord fairly soon because a mature market cannot go on expanding.
And what's happening, it seems to me, is that more and more people are reaching for these alternatives.
Yes, they are.
And anybody who goes out there and gets an Alembic and starts making them, distributing them amongst their friends and stuff will be doing the world a massive favour. And of course, exactly the process you described for feeding people something until they develop the symptoms is exactly what Edward Batch was using when he was putting flower petals on his tongue and determining what each of the flower essences would do.
Well, Edward Batch started off as a homeopath.
He did indeed. I'd forgotten
and
that.
He spent about 12 years looking into people's shit and making remedies from them, which are wonderful, I have to say. They're extremely good remedies. And then he had enough of foul-smelling things and went for sweet-smelling things instead and did the flower remedies. And he was wonderful.
Yeah. Yes, he wrote some great stuff as well. Yeah, I like the Bach flower remedies. They were really my first ever encounter with complementary medicine, and I remember spending a very fizzy weekend with my type remedy, and it really, I could feel it making a difference to the way I thought. It was quite remarkable. It's a major change, really.
Yes, they are absolutely amazing. And, you know, all of us who know about them use them a great deal.
And that's another thing to have in your first aid kit, of course, with your arnica, is the bark flower rescue remedy.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, well, we're going to have a bit of a music break. You're listening to Dr. Rock chatting with Stella Berg about homeopathy and related accidental subjects that come along. We've got about five or six minutes of music. And the first one's called A Mad Apple Circus, Let the Jury Sing. And that was the Eels and the absolutely fabulous Soul Jacker Part 1. I don't think anybody's turned out anything that sounds quite like that. And we've just heard about the forming of the BNA and the effective disenfranchisement of all homeopaths as a result. So thanks for joining us again, Stella. Are you still with us?
I'm still with you and enjoying this immensely.
Brilliant. I just want to talk a bit more about the proving. We covered most of that, which is a pretty, that in itself isn't that a simple and beautiful way of basing a science? You know, compared with all the complexity we're faced with, you've explained that what can cause something can cure it, and that energetically it's possible to cause symptoms to arise without actually experiencing the disease. I mean, that is miraculous, isn't it?
It is, and it is also an example of collective human endeavour, which I like.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's, like we said earlier, I think that's basically what we're missing. And I think another thing that interested me about this proving method was the business of looking at how much of the population gets a given effect. So you're not just looking for the effects that happen to everybody. You're looking, you said, effects that go with 80%, effects with 50%, and effects with 20% of the population. That sounds like you're going to end up with quite a complex and useful matrix of remedies.
It's very nuanced. So, for example, one of our major remedies, I was referring to the specifics earlier, one of our most useful remedies is sulfur. And if I go to my standard textbooks on the provings of sulfur, there are at least 50 pages of information about it. And it's a major, major remedy. It's of use to almost everybody. And the interesting thing with the remedies we use a great deal, which we call polycrests or drugs of many uses, is that they develop like a character of their own. So, for example, when I'm teaching people about remedies, one of the characters I will describe is the person who is constitutionally a sulfur. And there are many nuanced different pictures, but the commonest one is what we call the ragged philosopher, somebody who talks a great deal and is fascinated by ideas, who will read 7 or 8 books at once, and you go into their houses and they are absolute chaos, but they're organized chaos. The owner knows where everything is, under the bottom of which pile is that receipt or what have you. And they have compendious memories. And once they start off talking, they don't stop. So, you know, they are inclined to write great long tomes, learned tomes, as Karl Marx did. Karl Marx was undoubtedly a sulfur.
Yeah.
And you can always tell when they're coming because, you know, you can smell them coming ahead sometimes. They don't necessarily take care of themselves. Hence the ragged philosopher.
Right. Another lovely metaphor, just in two words. A great way of remembering detail, you know?
Absolutely. So we have these characters. And for example, everybody recognizes them because they're human types. So for example, there's a remedy Lycopodium, which is great for any kind of abdominal problem, digestive, bowel, what have you. But the character of the person who needs it constitutionally is the doctor, the vicar, the lawyer, the priest, the person who is thin but with a big tummy and who stoops and is a little scholarly, and who gets terribly nervous before having to perform because all of those professions are about performance. They fart like mad. They can't resist chocolate. They will snatch chocolate from little children. And between 4 and 8 in the evening.
That's not the only thing they'll snatch from little children.
True. And between 4 and 8 in the evening, they suffer dreadful bowel problems, and feel grumpy and tired and antisocial. You know, you put all those things together, and when somebody who needs Lycopodium walks into my practice room, I usually recognise them within 30 seconds.
So there's hordes of these people wandering
around the
place.
There's hordes of these people, absolutely. Yes, it's one of the common male remedies.
I find that really interesting because something I'll talk to you about in more detail on another occasion, but as a result of almost complete mental and physical collapse over winter, I discovered through a man called Clive de Carle load of things that we're actually short of. And sulfur's one of them. Sulfur's one of the things that Clive says basically everybody's deficient in. So I find it quite interesting that we see, because you put a spoonful of this stuff in a glass of water once a day or something. Would homeopathic sulfur have the same effect?
Homeopathic sulfur is one we use on a great number of people, and it helps with fatigue and procrastination and can't be botheredness. Mm-hmm. And disorganisation. It helps you to tighten up.
Great. So that's another one for my shelf then.
Absolutely. Everybody should have it in the house.
Yeah.
And it's very good after somebody's had an acute ailment and is not really getting back to normal as fast as they should.
Right. Okay. Now we've got a question in the chat box from Freeman Jack. Hi there, Jack. It says, and Jack's well out advanced in the left field and all sorts of other parts of the field where nobody else is playing. He says, is your guest familiar with Wilhelm Reich's work in characterology?
Not specifically, in a sort of general outline, yes, but I should know more than I do.
I've not even heard of characterology. I've obviously heard a lot of Wilhelm Reich, but that's what Jack does to you.
Yes.
So
it's along the same lines, constitutional types, we call them.
Right, and Edward Batch had the same thing, didn't he? You have type remedies. I'll ask you about constitutional remedies in a bit. The first thing I want to talk a bit about diagnosis. And before I ask you a question, I'd just like to read the description you came up of my type the other night after probably less than 10 questions. And I really enjoyed answering your questions, by the way. They were great. And the reason I want to read it out is because I think it's an excellent example of where skilled application of classical homeopathic techniques can actually take us. I mean, it's a cracking example of how it works and compares, in my opinion, most impressively with, say, 10 minutes in a GP's surgery. Because what you said to me is that my type, not me personally, but my type, is solid, temperamentally calm, prone to low-level anxiety. First two, I'd say it's up to other people to comment on, but prone to low-level anxiety is definitely a really spot-on. You only have to ask Jess; she'd verify that. The type makes good friends, has no malice, like long-term relationships and stability. And the one I really liked was don't like to be looked at when under stress, because that's an unusual thing to say. It's absolutely bang on. It's really impressive and why I love a good homeopathic, because on the subject of not liking to be looked at when under stress, that's like a really core heart of the matter observation for me, because as far as I'm concerned, flight beats fight every time. And I'm like with Terry Pratchett's Rinse Mind once said, dying only happens once, running away is forever. So I read that out because I think it's a real revelation and very informative to me, very helpful. But as you say, a diagnosis isn't a cure, is it? It's simply a label.
It's simply a label, and it's a useful tool because I work with people for decades. I'm now treating the grandchildren of people I started off treating, being their family doctor, as it were. But if somebody knows their constitutional type, several things result from that. One is that, because going back to the image of the atom, the old-fashioned image of the atom, if I know what someone's constitutional is, I know quite likely what their acute remedies are going to be that circle round that constitution. And that is where the home prescribing becomes so interesting, because I can say, if you're a calc, which is what we were describing just now, then you're likely to need Nux Vomica and Belladonna and Pulsatilla and Silica, and a few other remedies, because those are the ones which naturally revolve around your constitutional remedy.
Right.
And then, so I can take down with your history, I can take down what sort of ailments you get, whether they're sore throats or headaches or, you know, gut problems or hot feet burning that you need to stick out at night is a common calc one. And stuff like that. And I can give you those remedies to use at home and you learn how to use the acute remedies and you come to me for the chronics.
That's absolutely cracking as well, that this kind of, so it's yielding a kind of spectrum of things that you're going to need under different circumstances.
Likely to. It's always statistical and there are exceptions. But what it means is going to a homeopath can be a learning and unfolding process. And after a period of months or years, then you get to know your remedies very well and you do most of the prescribing yourself. And you only come to me when you're stuck, which is obviously the best way to do it.
Well, it means A, you're taking responsibility, which is one of the most important things, but it also means there's a kind of intellectual and physical or active interaction with whatever it is that's afflicting you or you're afflicting yourself with.
Yes. So when you get ill, instead of getting frightened, you can look through your notes and say, well, these are the six remedies I've been given in case. Does it fit any of them? And if so, then you have a tool and the fear level immediately starts going downwards.
Yes, because, again, lack of control is one of the things that I think we're all experiencing. And I think it's why people have got high blood pressure and stress and depression and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that you find consistently about very experienced homeopaths is the calmness. You know, I am morally certain, although I never did the lab tests, of course, that I've treated meningitis 5 times. And it is no more difficult to get rid of than any other fever, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you've had that experience, and I must emphasize that I did all the proper things of suggesting people go to hospital, et cetera, because that is something I have to do. But nevertheless, they chose to stay with me. The fever went down in 10 to 12 minutes like it does with any other fever. Therefore, I have not got fear associated with treating people with serious disease.
10 to 12 minutes to get rid of fever?
Yeah.
Tidy.
Yes.
Yeah. I hear that vitamin C is really good for dealing with a lot of stuff like that.
Yes, it can be. The thing is, you need to know what the fever is there for, though.
Mm.
You know, fever has a function like all illness does, and you don't necessarily want to get rid of it instantly because what it's doing is burning off the bugs.
Yeah.
And in Victorian times, people with cancer were actively given an incentive to get colds because that would ramp up their immune system and make it easier for them to cure themselves.
Mm.
So, you know, we have respect for what the body's trying to do. and we try and help it rather than get in its way.
It's a good idea to recognise that it kind of knows better what it's doing than we do. We don't have to think about breathing or making our heart beat or anything.
Exactly right, yes. Bodies have been evolving for millions of years. They're wiser than our brains are.
Mm. Got a question from Midrin in the chat box saying, how do we find our constitutional type?
You'll need to go and see a homeopath, probably.
Ah, there you go, Midrin. There's always a catch, mate.
Well, you know, you can read through torrents and torrents of books if you want to, but there is always a difficulty of identifying your own stuff because of your cherished delusions about yourself.
Yeah, you can only examine it through your own mental furniture.
Well, that's right. But basically, it's nothing in homeopathy is straightforward, and you don't necessarily have one constitutional, you can have a cluster of them.
Right, and each of those might have the little electrons spinning round it to you.
That's right.
Yeah.
You only have to think of people you know. You know, generally speaking, people are in one mode, one state of mind, like, you know, the middle-aged member of the WI who's always kind and generous and warm and hospitable. But under pressure, or if she thinks her husband is cheating on her, she might get extremely malicious. Now, that would be moving over to a different part of her constitutional pattern.
Yeah.
So nothing is simple. People are not simple.
I remember, to get around the simplicity problem, when Jess was doing her training for the batch flower remedies, or Bach, as she likes to say it, because she's Welsh and it sounds nicer, she was asked as an exercise to imagine what she might treat various fairy tale characters. People like Cinderella was one of her favourites, but she went right over the top and decided that she'd do the ugly sisters and everybody else involved.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because, for example, when I'm doing my trainings with students, I use quite a lot of novels, because quite a lot of novelists went to their homeopaths to check their characters. Right?
Shrewd move.
What?
Shrewd move.
Absolutely. So, for example, James Compton Burnett was one of my heroes. He was a homeopath in London. And his nieces were Ivy and Frances, and Frances wrote The Secret Garden. All the characters in The Secret Garden are homeopathic portraits.
That makes it worth reading in itself, doesn't it, really?
Absolutely, it does.
Because you'll be taking in information in story form, which is the way we've traditionally done it, still do.
It's on my first year schedule every year to read that. Mm. And in fact, one of the homeworks is to take any Shakespeare play, and nearly everybody takes Romeo and Juliet, prescribe them their remedies, and then rewrite the end of the story.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I think it's a shame they always go for Romeo and Juliet. My advice would be to go for Macbeth.
Oh, that would be fun.
It's fabulous. We saw one, actually. I've just had a week of an international sharing Shakespeare festival at the Willow Theatre, and we had a 3-dozen-strong team of youngsters called the Gobstopper Theatre Company, who did an absolutely ripping 50-minute edge-of-the-seat production of Macbeth. I mean, I've seen it a dozen times, and it was so exciting, even though you know what's going to happen. You know, they were brilliant. They really were. And there's a lot of stuff in Shakespeare. It's something that I do talk about on the show, unusually for kind of rebel radio and stuff, because I'm realizing that the more you know when you come to the text, the more you're going to find in the text. So if you know stuff that nobody else who's read Shakespeare has known, you will find things in it that haven't yet been found. And I find that that's one of the things that's engrossing about his work, whether he was a he or a they. It is fascinating how it works like that.
It is, isn't it? I would love, really, to unravel the mystery of Shakespeare. Because I judge my literature on some level, by its accuracy of portrayal of humans. And again, they're all homeopathic characters. Falstaff, for example, his death scene is a pure description of a death by arsenic poisoning.
Right. Yeah, you couldn't be blamed probably for poisoning Falstaff.
how many playwrights would get the description exactly dead on?
He or they seem to have known all manner of stuff about medicine, about law, about shamanism, about nature. philosophy, politics, money. The list appears to be pretty much endless, which is why I guess we still see it on the stage, which is what makes me think that it is part of the programme running as well.
Yes, I think you're right. And that there is definitely something behind it.
Canops wrote debate saying, so can we debate who wrote it? I'd love to have that conversation at some point with somebody who's done the research. Ken, if you know anybody who has, put them in touch. And definitely, definitely, that is one of the things that would be absolutely top of my list to do. I'd be fascinated.
Read Oscar Wilde on the Dark Lady.
I'll do that. I will. I'll take that one up as well. Another one that I really liked, I think, was called Iron... Was it called The Iron Man? Ooh, no, I'll have to look that one up. It was a breakdown of a really complex fairy tale into kind of Jungian representations, and that struck me. It's a shame I can't remember its name at the moment. It does happen, unfortunately, when I'm live. Just to return a little bit to the electrical nature of these remedies, we seem to be entirely an electrical system. And indeed, if you talk to Freeman Jack, who we heard from earlier, you'd be told probably that the whole thing is electrical, the plants, the planetary systems, all of it. So is there a relation between these electrical systems in the little tablets and our electrical system in any way?
Oh, yes. Homeopathy dates back to the time when we thought there was a difference between a live person and a dead person. And of course, now science has proved there isn't. So we belong to the time of animism or the spirit. And from our philosophy, the view is that humans are endowed with a vital force or a vital spark, which leaves you when you die. It's not the soul. It's kind of like the butler of the system. And it is intelligent, and it is self-healing, and it is adaptable. And it runs all the very, very myriad complex events happening in the body from moment to moment. But it can get ill. And when it gets ill, when people get ill, it's always the vital force that gets ill. And then it stops in its duty of keeping the body repaired, and symptoms begin to appear, right? So what I do when I'm taking a case is I'm not trying to find out what's wrong with the body by itself. I'm trying to find out how and why, in what state the vital force is ill. And it's doing a body audit. It's doing an audit emotionally, physically, mentally. What is the state of this person? Which is expressing what Hahnemann called the untunement of the vital force. Right. So when I've done that, when I've got most of the jigsaw pieces together, I look for a remedy whose provings made the same jigsaw picture. And then I prescribe that. Because it's electrical, I'm feeding it back to the body, to the vital force, a bit like a 19-pin plug going into a 19-hole socket. If you get the wrong number of pins, it won't go. So it's got to be the right remedy, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah, that makes loads of sense.
And then the vital force looks down at itself and says, oh, is that what I'm doing? And begins to repair it in an order of the hierarchy of importance of the bits that have gone wrong. So if I'm treating you and you've got heart disease and sore feet, it will always do the heart first.
God, again, see, that's something that you can hear and just pass by. But when you realise that... That's how it works, that it basically treats hierarchically and deals with key stuff first and then works its way to less important organs. That's, again, it all just strikes me. When you step aside from it just a bit, look at it a bit of askance, it's really strange.
Well, it's assuming that you have a complex, intelligent, coherent organism. And when it gets untuned, I do quite like that. It's an old-fashioned expression, but it's a good one. It can't by itself repair that. So what you're doing is taking an audit. Look at the state of you. You know, your heart's not working and you're putting on weight and you're getting cold and your endocrine system is a little bit out of balance. Just look at it. So the vital force looks at it and says, okay, well, clearly I need to do this and this and this and this and this. And all the remedies are is a report. They're a report written in the body's own electrical language. So the body can hear it and respond to it.
I guess if we're talking about a specific charge, we're talking about frequency, aren't we? And we're definitely resonant frequency beings.
Yes.
And those are tiny, tiny, tiny little adjustments that make all that difference.
Well, they're energetic adjustments. They put the tuning back to the violin to where it should be.
Mm.
And you can hear the difference. You know, sometimes, my goodness, sometimes I give a remedy to a person and within moments they say, my God, the pain's disappeared.
Mm.
Or they burst into tears, or their faces are flooded with colour, or little children very often will go to sleep and sleep for 20 hours after a remedy, as their bodies concentrate on repair, and they wake up, they're out of all proportion better.
And it's all so cheap and simple.
Doesn't need refrigerating. The oldest remedies we know are about 170 years and still going strong.
I was going to ask you that, actually, whether they had a shelf life. I mean, presumably it's best to keep them out of bright sunshine and in dark brown bottles and all that kind of stuff, but if you do that, they just keep.
Yes, indeed they do.
As long as you don't touch them and discharge them.
I had a small homeopathic book once, which was a, you know, real beginner's book. And in the preface to it, it said, this is a book for Methodist missionaries. And it was sent out all over the world with the missionaries. And I think it had a great influence on why a lot of people in our colonies, became Christians, because the missionaries prescribed homeopathically for them. It's a bit of lost history.
Hmm. Interesting. Yes, I've not heard that, but it makes a lot of sense, that does. Because Jess was telling me that when she's abroad, what people are quite often after is Western medicine. They think because you're a Westerner, you've got a bag full of antibiotics, and they're willing to buy them off you just one or two at a time. Perhaps that's a memory of the homeopathic days.
I think it might be, because it's always been a puzzle to me why people would convert to a religion like Christianity, which is so full of blood and gore.
Mm.
But if it was accompanied by a really powerful healing tool, well, there you have it.
Yes, mixing the old knowledge with the new myth.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the metaphors you used when we were chatting previously, and I thought was extremely effective at explaining why it is that we sometimes become diseased, was what I've got down here as the bucket metaphor. Do you remember the one I mean?
Yes, I do. Okay. Why people don't know what has triggered them becoming ill is because it's a process becoming ill, and the symptoms are actually an end product. So, for example, if you spend months and years being stressed, being tired, eating the wrong food, your health is like a bucket that is slowly filling up more and more. And at some point, when you have eaten your last fish and chips, it overflows and you get a whole load of symptoms. And you look back and you can't see why it would affect you, because you've always been able to eat fish and chips before. But it's not about the fish and chips. It's about the bucket overflowing. And people do need periodically to clear themselves out if they're not to just reach saturation point. And then the body just says, I give in. I'm just going to go AWOL and have a tantrum.
So how often would you reckon? I mean, obviously it varies from person to person, and when you're in crisis, the answer would be different. But, you know, by and large, how often do you think it's necessary to come and have this sort of reset, to visit a homeopath and have a spanner taken to it?
Ah, well, you're asking several different questions there at once. For visiting a homeopath, I personally suggest people come spring and autumn around the equinox, because that's when people get ill. So that's quite a useful MOT, because you take more care of your car than you do of your body. As for keeping yourself fit, well, every decade you need to work harder to keep yourself on a level footing. But, for example, when you're 20, you can do almost anything and your body will bounce back. But as you get older, then it's worth looking into regularly fasting a day a week, or doing a good clean diet once a month, perhaps the first of the month for a week. Learning how to take care of yourself is one of the things a good homeopath should teach you. so that you become, by and large, a self-maintaining organism. You should know how often to clean up, how much foods you should eat in moderation, and what foods. And generally, start accumulating simple information, like, for example, you should know what your tonsils look like in health, because then when you've got a sore throat, you can look in your throat and see what you've got that's different.
Yeah, and things like what your tongue looks like.
Absolutely. So it's all tied up with the process. I personally, what I like to do is get to know a patient and see them several times over a year. Get to know them, teach them to get to know themselves. And then if it suits them, put them on this program of seeing them twice a year for an MOT. But most of the rest of the time, they should be increasingly enjoying looking after themselves and deriving the benefits from that.
Yes, what a fantastically honest aim.
Well, we should aim to put ourselves out of business.
Brilliant, because you're not just healing people, although I know we're probably not supposed to use that word, you're also empowering them, which has got to help the healing process.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We should never have become so ignorant. We have now young mothers growing up, coming along, who don't know that their children can't die of earache. And they are pumped full of fear and more fear and more fear. And one of the things I really love doing is helping them come back to calm, knowledge, competence, comfort. And it's not that difficult to do.
No, I love that saying, we're here to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable.
I hadn't come across that one, isn't it?
It must have been, you said earlier that you're now treating the grandchildren of people that you were treating several years ago. It must be especially helpful, isn't it, to be on your third generation? Do you find that information travels to a degree from one generation to the next?
Most certainly it does, yes. Constitutions do as well. Sometimes you get a cluster of constitutions, like a parent of one sort will tend to generate a child of an opposite sort. If you think of a very overbearing parent, you can see that the child is quite likely to be rather timid, for example.
It's my experience that children quite often react against their parents and therefore get on better with their grandparents.
Yes, indeed. So you can see there are family clusters. But where I treat an extended family, it's a delight, an absolute delight.
And does everybody, presumably everybody gets on better as a result of that?
It's commonly what we're asked to work on. And the nice thing is, you know, I obviously have a big family practice, but what is lovely is that the children love coming to see me, partly because they get sweet tasting tablets at the end, but also I think simply because they get treated with respect.
Yes.
You know, I ask for their views on things. I ask them to tell me what their favourite foods are. I'm very concerned to hear their views about how they feel and if they're feeling angry or if they're frightened at night. And, you know, it's very interesting to see how many children are clearly not listened to very much how other children are clearly listened to far too much and dominate the family.
Yes, yes. From my observation, a lot of the children I see out and about are not shown a lot of respect by the older generations.
No, I had a teenager brought in to see me a few years ago for basically breaking down the home and bashing holes in the walls and screaming and shouting and all sorts of things. He was 13 at the time and a big lout of a boy, you know. And he was brought in kicking and screaming, pretty much. And I started asking him about it, and I said, do your parents quarrel a lot? And he said, well, yeah, they're always shouting at each other. And I said, okay, do you feel it's got anything to do with you? Is it your fault? And he said, they're always saying it's my fault. And I simply said, look, at 13, nothing is your fault. Mm-hmm. And he burst into tears.
Yeah.
And I looked at his mum and saw her reaction, and I knew they were all going to be all right as a family because she took it.
Yeah.
She saw the point and she took it.
Yeah.
And the family dynamic changed. So counselling obviously comes into this a lot, and just listening to people is so often really precious.
And that also, that experience possibly helps them to learn how to communicate better with each other.
Yes, yes, they're now doing fantastically well, all of them. But they were a very stressed, noisy, unhappy family before. I think the sheer luxury of having an hour and more with a person means that you can hear, and then you can hear the things that they can't say.
Yes, yeah. And the same, that's as true of a of the rest of us as it is of a homeopath, isn't it? Because again, those kind of listening skills can be extremely helpful just in themselves in a domestic or a non-domestic situation.
Well, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's certainly not exclusive to us by any means. But if we know what somebody's constitution is, and, you know, by now, mostly, I would say 80% of the time, I can see what someone is when they come in. I know what questions to ask. I know what they're afraid of. I know a good deal about them just from the first few minutes of talking. And that does make counselling easier.
Yeah. Yeah. You could probably adopt a crystal ball and a veil and stuff and help out at the village fair being a bit of a clairvoyant.
It has been known, actually.
It's interesting, isn't it? I noticed as we went through there that you said people normally get ill around the equinox, around the big changes in season. That's an interesting tie-in with our mother planet, is it not?
It is. Astrology is very helpful in a lot of these areas. But that one is a very straightforward one because, apart from anything, it's very close to the coats on and coats off time. And the thermostat is often slow adjusting to the change of season.
Right. So it's the sickness, the disease is set off by instability in the system around us.
Well, all sorts of things. But for example, over the winter, you might stop refrigerating your food quite so carefully because it's cold, and then suddenly it's warm and the bugs proliferate. Mm-hmm. All the way through to, you know, you go out without a coat one day and you get colder. And that is as well as all possible astrological changes.
Mm. Well, the astrological thing is interesting to me because I see that as a kind of macrocosmic version of homeopathy, because just like all the remedies and every cell in our body is, every element is basically, an individual frequency, so are every single one of the stars.
Yes. If I weren't a homeopath, I'd be an astrologer. And I often do people's charts if I'm getting a little bit stuck for some reason.
Yeah, very good. Yeah,
they're very integral to each other. They work very well together.
I have had one or two absolutely stunning interactions with astrologers who have been as revelatory to me of things that I knew well but had never recognised as the homeopaths have been.
Mm. Yeah, well, they're two beautiful systems.
Yeah. Well, we're working our way into the last 10 minutes now. I'm going to kind of tie up with one or two conclusions in a minute. But first of all, I wonder if you could, you said to me the other night that you were once the secretary for a hall of residence for a medical college, and you described to me three critical questions on the application forms. Can you remember the details of that? I've got them written down, if not.
Yes, I can. Every student had to apply with a photograph and a questionnaire. And it was basically very straightforward about their qualifications and so forth. But at the end, there were three questions which struck me immensely at the time and have always stayed with me since. The first question was the religion of the family. This is students applying to stay in the hall as medical students, right?
Yeah.
The first question was the religion of the family, and I noted with interest that about 50% of them were Catholics, and the general Catholic view about your body is the less you know about it, the better, because it's full of sin. The second question was, are there any medical people in your family? And about 80% of them had either doctors or nurses already in the family. And that related to the third question, which was, why do you want to be a doctor? And it became very apparent that there was one answer expected as the standard answer. And I'll give you a moment or two just to think about what it might have been. The commonest answer, status.
100%. said status.
No, the ones with the medical families said status.
The ones with the medical families, and they were 80%.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I've just got a comment after that which says, like, wow. Because that smells of a fix, doesn't it?
Well, it means they were giving the answers they'd been coached to give and the answer that was expected and gave you the highest marks. And that's worrying.
This is another version of peer review, is it not?
Yes.
But used as a...
Also, it to me, it means something else again, which is a subject we haven't had time to cover this evening, which is the priest-healer archetype. And I think what it indicates is that the medical environment knows very well what the priest archetype is, and they milk it for all it's worth, because it's a very powerful archetype to give comfort or alternatively to frighten. Because doctors, if you go to a hospital and you get a diagnosis of cancer, that is a curse.
It is absolutely a curse. Even begins with the same letter.
Yes, that's right. And it's very important. You can't give a curse unless you are the holder of the priest-healer archetype.
Yeah, that's very good. Well, as you know, hoping to have you on again to chat about the other half of the subjects that we chatted about the other night, which does include some very interesting thoughts on archetypes and Jung. It will be, I suspect, a conversation of a different quality, and I will add that to the notes for that show, because that's also interesting input. Because, of course, if we're saying there's hordes of people running around the place who need sulfur and stuff, then these archetypes are a good way of us learning the kind of learning about the historical kind of situations that we find ourselves in, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, it's a fascinating insight into how you can empower your life is looking at the archetypes and seeing which ones you can inhabit, or which ones you can ask to inhabit you, perhaps, is more appropriate.
Rob Freeman's put in about that comment about the priest-healer archetype, because he knows a lot about priests, I can tell you, and the court system, and he's put, ooh, very interesting that, Stella, so you caught Rob's interest there. So, kind of in conclusion, on this chat at least, I suppose one of the first things we've got to do is realise that there's a problem, and then open the gate to a solution, isn't it? It's really important.
Yes. Yes, I think so. You know, if we're talking strictly about how to mend oneself, how to empower not just your health, but your well-being. You know, health is not an absence of disease. Health is the presence of joy and confidence and comfort and security in life. So that learning how to restore that when it's gone, learning how to help other people restore that, seems to me one of the basic human functions that we have temporarily, I hope, lost.
Yes. Yeah, well, we do seem to be getting back a lot of stuff that was apparently lost.
Yes, I think we are, and that's what's so exciting about it.
Well, as you said to me the other night, you said you've been waiting for this all your life.
Yes. Well, I'm here to do this. It's what I do best, and I'm delighted over the decades to find that although the press still is paid a large amount of money to keep slamming us, actually what's happening is it's getting normalised amongst people. The idea of getting to know yourself and getting to medicate yourself.
And coincidentally introducing yourself to elements of your environment that you might previously have been unaware of.
Yes. I mean, the self-awareness programme is well underway now. And it's so gratifying to see it.
It is, and it's changing at a hell of a rate now, isn't it? In all fields, I think.
Yes, I think we're winning, actually, I have to say.
Yeah.
We're winning this battle.
Yeah. I noticed that one of the things you said was that you think that the Illuminati were running out of road.
Yep.
Absolutely great. And another thing you said was that it's important to attend to people and to the environment. That's, again, something that is essentially missing currently from the people that are being voted into power.
Well, do you know, it's an interesting thing, Ben, but at some point, if we have another conversation, I would quite like to introduce your listeners to some of the things that they could do for the environment, especially as they're likely to be disseminated quite widely geographically. We need to think about putting some remedies into reservoirs for universal use.
Great. Well, we can do that. We've got shed loads of reservoirs here, and we'd be treating Birmingham. It all runs through a Victorian gravity-fed brick tube all the way to Birmingham from Mid-Wales.
Oh, is that Lake Vronwy?
No, they're called the Elan Valley Reservoirs. There's three of them, and they were flooded by the Birmingham Corporation, being Welsh-speaking areas, some 100 years or so ago, which involved the creation of what were little better than prison camps, really. And it's that's another story indeed. Rob's just put about the priest healer archetype. He's put that's a subject for a show in itself. So I've asked Rob if he's interested. Perhaps you'd like to come and play too.
Oh, I'd love to. Because
I think that'd be a brilliant, and the archetypes is one of the things I do understand about Jung, because I've waded my way through a couple of books on that, and studied psychology at some point anyway, a long time ago.
Discussion then, that would be lively.
It would, wouldn't it? It'd be great. Yeah, I think we should get in amongst that. I'll see if I can, see if I can lure him into the studio with, offers of G&T and pastries or something. So, realize the problem, recognize that there is a need for initiation of and participation in one's own healing. Go where you are useful was another thing you said, which I think is brilliant.
Yes. Remind me about that one.
Yeah. Just, that's just what you said. And I figure that, you know, we've been pretty nomadic for the last 4 years, wherever it is that because we haven't had our own front door and our own fuel store and food store and address and all that kind of stuff. If somebody says, hey, we're going to be, oh, I don't know what, building, a thermal mass rocket stove in a roundhouse, and it'll take 4 days, we can say, hell yeah, we need somewhere to be. We'll go there. So by not having a steady base, it makes opportunities look like opportunities. And one of the things I like to encourage people to do is to be able to spot the opportunities that are arising from your environment and from the people around you.
Well, you know, I think that goes deep, 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 deep into our history, because of course we were nomadic. And, you know, it's hardwired into us to hear about a good place to be and to make tracks for it. And I think it satisfies something very profound in human psyche, really.
Yes, again, a simple solution, you know, yes. But you've got to be looking for it.
And it's what human communication is about. You know, I know this wonderful spring. I know these wonderful people. There is this magic mountain you must go and visit. This has been going on for all of human history, hasn't it?
Yeah. I think communication really is, and our failure to communicate really is at the coalface. As I think is your amazing questioning technique, because it's not just with homeopathy. Again, one solution to many, many, many of our apparently varied challenges is to learn how and when to ask a good question.
Yes. Yes. And the love offensive. This is one of my passions. You know, if you go out love first towards everybody and you love the people you meet, after a few minutes, if not less, you do love them. And they respond like flowers, because everybody wants that and needs it. And the more loving you are up front, you taking the risk, the more wonderful responses you get from people. And that's a very old-fashioned way of looking at the world.
I think that's another really, really important thing to say, is that that is why and how the behaviour of an individual changes the world, is because it changes the way the individual is responded to by the creatures around it.
Well, the universe is reciprocal. It gives you what you give it.
Yeah.
You give it hostility and fear, it'll feed you back lots of fearsome things. You give it love, you receive love. My life is full of love.
Mine too.
It should be. That is how humans function best.
A lot of people miss the projection reflection function, don't they?
Yes. But the universe is lovely. It sings in harmony to the tune that you start.
Yeah. The cosmos is on your side, people. And a final thing, which I think was another really good point before I let you go, was you said don't rush, because timing is the most difficult skill to get.
Yes. There's an old Indian saying, if you don't know what to do, don't do anything. Because when you it's time to move, there it will be.
And I think implicit in that is one last thing, which is it's important to know not only when to stay still, but when to stay quiet.
Oh, now that's a hard skill to learn.
Certainly is, but I found me and Jess have both found it to be really, really effective. So effective, in fact, that there are several people now who notice when we're not saying something.
Yes. Well, there are different forms of eloquence, and silence is one.
Certainly so. And I'd say that another thing that really changes people's attitudes to you is the colour of the clothes you wear.
That's interesting.
Well, I've taken to wearing things like bright yellow shirts and my own custom-made pink camouflage trousers and things like that, and everybody seems to be friendly. People just kind of seem to automatically trust you. I just tell them I'm anticipating a world in which only pink combats work, only pink camouflage works.
Do you know, you could make some very interesting videos about soldiers in pink, couldn't you?
You certainly could. It's the soldiers that look at them really strangely. You can see them. They do that undressing thing. They look at the kind of whatever's on top. Then you can see them peel you down. They look down your combats, and then they just look away without looking up again.
Do you think it would be possible to Photoshop some of these horrible videos of coppers being so aggressive with shields and stuff and just make them all pink?
Yes, it's quite difficult to recolour them, I think, because they're all black.
What a shame. That would be great fun, wouldn't it?
But there must be, you know, they can do anything with CGI. It would be a bit of a laugh, wouldn't it? It must be possible, actually. It must be possible, and I think that would be great. I think it would. Well, anyway, Stella, it really has been a total joy to talk to you. It has.
Thank you.
And like I say, you're really welcome back on the show to talk about all those other things that we didn't actually get through tonight. And some comments from the chat room. Patrick said this Stella's spot on, more than I can say for the other Stella I used to drink. Rob Freeman said, what a top show, top guest and host. Brilliant. So I think, and great show, Doc, and Stella from Patrick. And I'm sure there'll be more of that as we play out with a couple of tunes. I will actually stay on with you folks until midnight, just spinning some tunes so I can go and drink my beer to them in the kitchen with the posse. Hi out there, posse. Hi to everybody in the chat box. Thanks to everybody that's been listening. Thanks to Raconteurs Radio, of Raconteurs News, of course, for enabling me and to be here. And big, big thanks to you, Stella, both for being here and for doing what you do. I think you're amazing.
Well, thank you. You've given me a very interesting evening and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Well, I mean, if you'd like to think about it, I'd be really happy to have you on as a kind of semi-regular correspondent, because I think we've got acres of stuff that we could be talking about together.
Well, if your listeners can endure it, I'll do that. Yeah, happy to.
I suspect they'd be keen to have you back. Oh, look, there's Jay, who's the lady who's houses the kitchen posse and keeps them in order, and gives me a broadband too. Thanks, Jay. Glad you enjoyed the show. I'll see you in a minute. And Andy's saying top show, Doc and Stella. Thanks. Lovely guest, Doc from Midrin. So yeah, you've gone down really well. You'd be definitely more than welcome back.
Thank you, Ben. And thanks so much for running this marvellous show. It's good fun.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to stay in touch, I'm sure. Thanks for being there.
All right. You take care now.
Yeah, I'll be catch up with you on the email.
All right.
Cheers, Stella. I'll let you know when the podcast's up. It'll be quick. Be up by the weekend, I reckon.
All right.
Brilliant. Okay. See you then.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot. There you go. Stella Berg there. I just feel that almost everything that we talked about tonight was almost the subject for a show in itself. I think we covered an enormous amount of ground, and as I say, from the 1 hour conversation I had with Stella the other night, unfortunately missing the show with Guy Taylor, but I'll catch it on the pod. But in that hour we talked about enough stuff to run a couple of shows, so we're already ready to do another one. But next week I'm not sure who's on, although there's several plates spinning on that. And the week after, we will finally be off to the Conscious Tribal Gathering, where there's several interesting presenters. And what we're going to do there this year is we're going to broadcast live on a dongle and a 12-volt system from a tent on the hill. And we're going to have the show going on in the main marquee down the bottom of the hill, so that anybody who's kind of down there, hears anything or has got something they want to say, can come up the hill and give us their thoughts, because apparently there's going to be 200 people at the Conscious Tribal Gathering this year, and being as it is a kind of It's a sort of energetic offshoot of Truth Juice gatherings, which are, as you know, I believe, some of the finest gigs I've ever been to. Everybody who comes to it has actually got something to say. So I would think in a couple of weeks' time we're probably going to be scoring some interesting live radio and hopefully a few interesting canned ones as well. And I'm going to play a few tunes for you, as I say, because keep us all entertained, and maybe come back and do a little bit of, you know, telling you what things are, being as the radio player doesn't, because I think it's only fair if we're going to be playing these tunes that you get to hear what they are. Some of you will remember that we kicked off last week's show with a tune called Redneck Women by Gretchen Wilson, which went down well. Well, there's another one. It's called something like Aren't You Glad We're Not All California Girls. Be another one after that, then I'll be back with you.